but really in a like interesting intellectual conversation dynamic, our emotions aren't part of the conversation of reality. Like, we shouldn't be too attached to what we want things to be. And that takes out a lot of emotion out of the conversation, and it makes it easier for you to live in a world where you're curious about how the world is going to surprise you with a new variable that you weren't ready to had any awareness of being existent, and completely changing your perspective of something that you thought you already understood. Like, that should actually be approached with a playfulness. I just really feel like diffusing this fear of talking about things we don't yet understand that conflict with our image of the world.
You are now entering the information stream, a physical and digital world. No matter where you live or where you are, a device and connection brought you here, where you and I now interact. Together, we will challenge our basic assumptions and approach to life in the 21st century. Together, we will change the world. Welcome to 21st Century Freak. And I'm your host, Edward Veeam.
Welcome to 21st Century Freak. I'm your host, Edward Veeam, and I'm here today with Rasmus Anton, the unorthodox psychologist who you heard from before in a previous episode, as well as my brother, Alexander Veeam, who you've also heard from in a previous episode. We thought that we'd sit down and have a conversation, actually already yesterday, and while the conversation was amazing, I think it became a bit too mushed up to be in a podcast, so we thought we'd do another try today and have a conversation. Because something that I think really kind of binds us all three together is a strong belief that we can actually change the world. We all have a strong belief that we can create peace in this world. We have a strong belief that we can create equal opportunities in this world. And so what happens when we sit down together is very often we end up in a, at least in my mind, extremely inspiring conversation. And I'm really excited to see where that takes us today. Before we begin, both of you, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thanks, man.
Great to have you guys here.
Same.
As you know, I typically begin with a short meditation just to get into our element here and presence. So if we close our eyes and take a few deep breaths. And if we open our eyes, the world streams in. And it's in this stream of consciousness, or the information stream for the listeners, where we're all the same. And I'm convinced that it's enough common ground to stand on to have conversations where we will allow ourselves to challenge our basic assumptions. Even when it's uncomfortable. And I think both of you are very good at mentioning what makes us uncomfortable in the world. So I'm very excited for this. As you know, I typically begin with two questions. So we could start with Rasmus. Who are you and why are you here?
Hello, everyone. Hello, Edwards. Hello, Alex. Thank you for the time that you've given me, invited me here. Had a nice warm room for us to record and share our thoughts with the purpose of improving everyone around us. It's really nice. Thank you. My name is Rasmus. I'm someone that is fueled by the idea that I have the potential to heal people or have the potential to help people heal by themselves. I love human behaviors. I'm very interested in patterns, behavioral patterns. And my background is mostly in counseling therapies, general psychology, and industrial psychology. My main focus has always been on the human and identifying the many variations of humans, not only how they look like, but how they can behave. Ever since I've been young, I was extremely passionate about meeting as many different people as possible to understand what it is exactly that motivates their thought patterns and their behaviors. And I've been on this quest, and it has helped me immensely with my therapeutic elements with some of my clients. It has helped me put into perspective for them to understand what types of people they have had in their life. It has helped me help them understand what people they don't need around them. Psychology is a blessing and a curse. It can be used for you and against you. And my goal on this planet is to make sure that it is only used for mutual benefit and never in any other way. I would like to become the protector of the weak, but also a warrior against evil. I'm working on becoming a fearless empath, someone that does not think twice about doing the right thing. And my goal really here, alongside with all of the amazing people around me today, is to analyze our society, the many different cultures, the many different pressures from the Western world and many other areas of the world, and see if there is just the slightest chance that there are some very malicious personalities involved in the way that life is constructed around us and in the way that we are taught to become ritualistic in a common fashion compared to everyone around us. Are there any benefits? Are there any disadvantages? And most of all, what can we do better? So that's a little bit about me.
Thank you. I really appreciate the seriousness with which you spoke, because it really felt real. It felt like it was a genuine message. It felt like this is a genuine path you're on. I really respect the fact that you want to be the warrior for the weak and the warrior against the evil.
Thank you so much, man.
What about you, Alex? Where are you and why are you here?
Thanks for sharing, man. Nice seeing you get into flow like that. I'm here to hang out with two cool dudes that I really enjoy hanging out with. That always leads to productive conversation to the point where you can't really end it. So you have to tell each other to stop. Everyone shut up so that I can leave the apartment.
It's true.
So I'm here to hang out and be a 21st century freak as I am with my brother who created the concept of the 21st century freak. And what my goal is, first time I said potential, extracting as much potential. Second time I said raising the general level of ignorance. And by that, I don't mean raising ignorance and creating more ignorance, meaning just raising the bar of ignorance and making ignorant people less ignorant on just a general level. And so to expand upon that once again, my goal really is to create a system that you flee to, not flee from, where it really has the emotional intelligence and deductive critical thinking of science enough to actually be supportive of human beings, and generate more potential, as I said from the first time.
beautiful. I really like that. A system that we flee to, not from. Mm. That's a very, like, when you think about it, it's like you hear it and then you're like, wait, what am I running? Oh, yeah. I'm kind of running from the structures of today. Well, what am I going to run towards? Yeah, I guess it's Alexander Beam. Fuck me. Nice. And exactly. I like some of the threads we picked up here in our introductions. But before I jump in, maybe I also should answer who I am and why I'm here. I'm a 21st century freak. And I'm here today because I kind of felt like in our conversation yesterday, I felt like at least a moment of very, very, very strong optimism that there's actually like different ways of speaking about it, different ways of looking at things that can allow us to kind of have these breakthrough moments that lead to this system that we can flee to rather than from, that lead to us being warriors for the weak and to be warriors against evil. And they're not easy to come by, because something that was so enlightening during my first conversation with you, Rasmus, was this idea of narcissists, this idea of malevolent behavior. Because I think just in general, a very positive person. I have a strong belief that most people are good. I have a spiel almost every day on Instagram that I'm amazing, you're amazing, we're all amazing. And it's the same thing with the meditation in the beginning. Like, I genuinely believe that there are these intrinsic human qualities that are good, and that goodness resides within each and every one of us, no matter what. But it's that no matter what thing, which is a little bit naive, a little bit ignorant, because of course there is darkness, of course there is something bad in the world, because even if I'm honest with myself, I'm not purely good. There's a lot of dark, bad sides within me. But so then life is like this balance of like good and bad, and we try to be the best person we can be. But what you highlighted for me is that there's actually certain personalities that don't want good, that are generally out for you. And you really helped me understand that. And I think kind of what I've picked up on yesterday as we were talking was we were talking about like kind of the system at large. And like, but so like, if most people are good, why is this a system that we flee from rather than to? And in this conversation today, I want to properly explore maybe some optimism, maybe some hope, and maybe some, at least for my own sake, understanding for why it may be like this, but also what options do we have to change it? And I think we have everything we need in this room to create those ingredients and get the sauce. So let's find the secret sauce today.
Amazingly said, Edwards. I think we should start off with optimism before we dwell into the depths of darkness, of reality. Mm. Let's just quickly imagine an iceberg underwater. You can see the tip. You can see the white tip there. Well, those are people in power. And quite often in psychology, if you study personality psychology, you will start seeing the trend where you actually see certain types of personalities that are attracted to power positions. They're attracted to become a manager. They're attracted to become a CEO. And trust me, it's not because those positions sound cool. It's what comes with those positions, and that is power. And we all know that. Power positions.
But would you say, like, are they drawn to power positions, like, only bad people or narcissists, for example, only they are drawn to power positions?
Okay, so there are probably two reasons why someone would be drawn to a power position. That's a great question. And we have the yin and the yang here. We have the yin, which is the good one, right? Did the dog fart?
Yeah, the dog farted really. A little
extra protein, you know? Never good.
Okay. Yeah, sorry about that, guys. Let's continue.
So, okay, back to the... Yeah, why would anyone gravitate towards a power position? So, a good person wouldn't necessarily dream about the power position most of their life. Okay, sorry, I can smell it now as well.
Well, this is one of the positive things of getting corona and losing the sense of taste and smell.
Okay, sorry. Let me recap this again. So, a narcissistic person that is incapable of changing, someone that brings bad and doesn't believe in good.
Sucks life rather than creates, I guess.
Sucks life rather than creates. This type of person would be attracted to a power position because a power position gives them the capability to manipulate, right? And you can very easily manipulate others from a power position regardless of the context. You could be working at a Subway restaurant. You could be working at a big enterprise or tech company, whatever it is. Any kind of power. Mixed with a really malicious personality style, well, yeah, they're attracted to that because power can make it easier for the narcissist to manipulate someone. Now, why would good people get into leadership and management positions? It's almost for the opposite reason. Some people, including me, would want to get into those positions to make sure that there isn't a bad person in that position. That there isn't someone that is playing with people's mental health, giving them stress, anxiety, developing into depression, clinical depression. These narcissistic individuals abuse their power at any given time. They're opportunistic people. Now, a good person would either want to be on that power position to prevent that from happening, right? Or to lead themselves. A great leader that is an empathetic leader, that is not a narcissistic leader, wants the best for everyone, believes in mutual empathy, listens to others, understands other people's emotions, has emotional intelligence, isn't self-serving in every initiative, considerate, open, empathetic, honest, reliable. Right? So many of these attributes that the narcissistic evil person at the power position can never manifest. The only thing they can do is they can pretend like they're the person they're supposed to be.
Okay, but let's focus in on that. Like, what do you mean that they would pretend? Why could a narcissist not do these things?
Thanks for the question. So a narcissist could not display any of these positive characteristics that I just stated, as in honesty, empathy, openness, trust, because by nature, these individuals with these personality disorders, narcissistic personality disorders, there are many personality disorders, but I'm only talking about the narcissistic personality disorders. So antisocial personality disorder. So sociopaths, psychopaths, and narcissistic personality disorder. These are the three personality disorders that have a complete lack of empathy towards others. They only care about themselves. This can never change, but they're immensely intelligent and good at manipulating others and their vulnerabilities. Why can they not become this genuine person? Well, because they're running an operating system in their head that cannot be updated. They're running a Windows 98. No matter how many times you try to upgrade it, it always goes back to Windows 98. It almost seems to be at a permanent state there.
Yeah, and I remember from our earlier conversation that this builds a lot on the fact that if we're exposed to very strong traumatic experiences at a young age, that somehow create like a survival mechanism within us to essentially not cope with the trauma through empathy. Instead, we turn off the empathy in our coping mechanism. And when you compound that no empathy kind of behavior from an early age up to your 20s, you're pretty much gone.
Yeah.
Like, and it's very hard to, or according to you, also scientifically proven, if I believe I'm right, to gain that empathy.
It's impossible to gain, regain it. Yeah.
And like, that is, first of all, really hard for me to wrap around, because I want to heal the world, and to hear that there's certain people that we, so to speak, couldn't help, it really saddens me, even if they would be then bad people, as we're talking about them right now. But I'm also curious that, like, another thing we spoke about yesterday is, like, typically they're, like, 1 out of 10 people are under some kind of condition of these three that you mentioned?
Yeah, should be around 6 to 8% of the world should kind of...
Okay, so a bit less.
Have a lack of empathy.
Maybe at least 1 in every 20 people.
Yeah, probably 1 in 15, 1 in 16. Now, these statistics are based off statistics from the American Psychological Association and British Psychological Society. And both of these countries have a history of narcissism, right? And a lot of toxic leadership. So we cannot 100% rely really on any statistics, but this could be quite an understandable suggestion, even if we think around us, you know? Maybe 1 out of 15 people has a lack of empathy, you know? It's still a lot.
Yeah.
It's still a lot.
And it's not a stretch of the imagination to think that in safe countries, there would be less such people because there's less traumatic experiences.
Yes, yes.
But in a war-torn country, there's going to be a lot more of them.
That's a really good point there.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you're talking about there is ancestral trauma. Is the, if you look at Eastern Europe, if you go on Google right now, type in suicide rates in Europe, you're going to see the whole Eastern Europe is going to shine up. All of them, very similar high colors. Why? Why? Because they're Eastern European? Well, no. It's their history. It's the recent history. Is the Soviet Union, is the Balkan Wars between each other, is the deceit, the manipulation, the killings.
Political corruption.
Fear. And to some extent, fear is necessary to develop our personality. Our personalities are very fear-based mechanisms. It's the way that we handle stress, handle pain, avoid situations, or are attracted to situations. Am I a person that is attracted to opportunities where I can do good, or am I attracted to opportunities where I can do bad to others, but then feel good? Who am I? What is in my heart? And I feel that, as you said, these kinds of narcissistic tendencies, if not only narcissistic people, are more correlated to childhoods that have been exposed to more of the fear, different kinds of traumas, micro traumas, bigger traumas. And it's not always, for example, the difference between PTSD and CPTSD, so post-traumatic stress disorder and complex post-traumatic stress disorder, is that with PTSD, it could be something that happened to you once and it traumatized you. And the older you are, the more resistant, theoretically, you should be to that trauma compared to if you were really young, right? Because then your psychological system wouldn't be fully developed, your body wouldn't have been fully developed, on paper. But with CPTSD, so complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which could come from these war-torn zones where you hear a sound or a plane in the sky and you don't know if you're going to be bombed. You don't know if your family is going to die. Being in that constant stress on a daily basis, year after year after year, it really messes up your cortisol, the stress hormone. And that's what CPTSD, alongside any other kind of emotional disturbance on a daily basis, that's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And just because you have had trauma in your childhood doesn't mean you're going to become a bad person. some of the best people in this world, some of the people with the biggest hearts in this world have had so much trauma in their life. You can't even imagine. And even when they were young. But then you look at the other side of the coin, some people with those very same experiences, those very same traumatic experiences, turned out to become psychopathic serial killers, CEOs that sexually harass their staff and manipulate them into silence, blackmail them into silence. They could be anywhere else. And quite often these narcissistic individuals use their childhood as an excuse to kind of give back what was done to them. And this is because they have a lack of empathy. That's it.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm curious, Alex.
I'm loving this optimistic tone that you wanted to set off the episode with.
Oh, I forgot about it.
No. Don't apologize for that at all. Okay, and I know you didn't, but yeah. But people need to hear it. It's just hard for people to hear.
But I'm curious, Alex. Like, you're somebody who I would say is very good at feeling people out. Hmm. Like, what is your experience? Like, I know that also speaking to Rasmus has taught you a lot and maybe colors your views a little bit more than they did or how you would look at things before meeting Rasmus. But what is your sense of the psychopaths and these social disorders out there that or personality disorders out there that seem to be so malevolent? Like, I'm curious, because you feel things out a lot. Like, you get this intuitive feeling for something. Do you feel like there's a bunch of narcs and psychopaths and sociopaths running around out there?
I feel like there are a lot of empathetic people coping, trying to survive in a sort of an unhealthy, low emotionally intelligent society. So they emulate parts of narcissistic traits, but they never feel good about doing it, but they still do it. And then in leader positions, for sure. Like, because I can see if you look at government spending and like what a country makes money off of, like say, for example, Sweden, and I'm not going to take up the specific examples now. But when you look at, or I'll take just a super simple, clear one that a lot of people can relate to. So like, if you look at Sweden, we like to sort of fence ourselves around this reality where we're this good country that's safe, we're politically correct, we have a high level of equality, for example, and we see ourselves as being this good sort of critically thinking influence on our society and other countries around us. But we still, as a country, so as a politician, you know this, especially if you're in a high leadership position, you know that the money, you're still going to be making money off of countries that are doing horrific things towards women, horrific things towards children, and horrific things towards people in general, and the world in general, and the environment. But you're still going to stand on the pedestal pretending like you're doing the good. And it's kind of like you're dipping your toe into the sort of well of evil and good at the same time, but pretending like you're only good. And it's a complex question. Like, you can't, like, we don't have a perfect country or set up for countries today to live in a sustainable fashion where they don't have to be dependent on negative nations, if we just put them simply. Knowing that fact about a country and about what a country makes money off of. And then we also have the same with corporations. Larger corporations know where they get their money from and how they make their money. And in a lot of cases, if it's not a really, really deeply entrenched, like purposefully driven business, and it's more like, say, a stock market, like say, or you're making money off the stock market, or you're a big hedge fund or whatever. Well, there it's only about maximizing profits. That has nothing to do with the purpose. So you almost, you make a choice, like if you want to make money, you're going to make it off of the backs of a lot of people's lives and the planet's lives. And so you become an indirect psychopath. And maybe not all of them have to be narcissists all the time, but usually the leadership has to be. Because they have to want to own that position, protect it as a quote-unquote beautiful position when it really is quite the dark position that they're holding.
Well, I don't want to emphasize it that strongly because I definitely feel like
I'm trying to make
us good-natured people, like we all love competition, and both you two, as I look at you, I know that you guys are both extremely passionate, driven individuals. And so I definitely think that we can't blanket statement too much that all leaders are narcissists.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I was just saying that if you have, like, for example, then a seat at the political office, there's a strong chance that you have these narcissistic tendencies, from what I've understood from Rasmus, at least, that they have a... Like, because we know that the political world, like, they lie and they cheat and they kind of keep us away, withhold truth in various ways by directing focus in various ways. And so, like, they're more drawn to the position of being at that center stage, it feels like, rather than actually bringing about the reformation of change. Because a complex reformation of change, well, there's too much high risk involved in that. Like, if you don't do it right, the public might not like you for a couple months. And they just want to manage expectation, manage emotions, not face the trauma as you would in a setting where you're actually trying to work with yourself or work with the country.
If I try to condense a little bit what you said here, I mean, we started off with just like Sweden as a country and this idea that it's hard to be all good because obviously there's bad things happening, and that these bad things happening seem to be in part manipulation and in part evil things, and like, how do we put that together? And it's also that feeling I get when I look at the world, like, how do I put it together that most people are good but there's so much bad in the world? How's that possible? If most people are good, why is there so much bad? And I think another thing you were getting into here is that is kind of a key to understanding this is, so in part, we're these social animals that are incredibly dynamic and complex. Like, it would be very hard to define us perfectly because in a way we can change our personalities, we can change our interests, we can change our passions very quickly based on, you know, external things, but even just internal things. Like a certain revelation about yourself might take you on a new career path. So these incredibly complex animals. And so in order to organize ourselves, we've invented different ideologies and belief systems to, in a better way, manage the resources and to manage conflict in between different social animals. And I think, you know, capitalism today is really the hallmark of any ideology because I think it exists at large, all over the world, almost. And capitalism is this idea that we're driven by self-interest, and that we have the rule of law to kind of govern our societies and social behaviors, but that we're all free and are able to do whatever we want. And in this capitalistic model, we've developed these economical systems that are based on a shareholder model of maximizing profits. And in the same way that each individual is self-interested in trying to maximize his own utility, we've said that companies are self-interested and want to maximize profits, which is the key for these companies. When we were talking yesterday, that kind of something that just kind of clicked for me was that, okay, so that's capitalism, is this maximizing profits. And then you look at it like a nation state, a country. Again, like Iran, what is the incentive there? Well, that's really to maximize their own territorial power. At least if you look at history, that's the way we can say nation states behave. And this idea of like this maximizing self-interest is something we use academically because I think it's also very nice in capitalism because we can say, hey, we're all free. If you work hard, you can make it. So capitalism is good because it provides freedom or equal opportunity.
And of course, especially with the internet, where people actually have even access more to the information. Before so, it was kind of a myth or a dream. The it was only in books.
Yeah.
And
But now with the local to global connection, essentially, if we work on ourselves, if we train our attention, we can train our attention to acquire these skills and knowledge through the information stream, the internet, and literally, hopefully, do exactly what we set out to do in life. But to return to these institutions, these maximizing profits, maximizing self-interest, maximizing the nation interests, there's something about the structure of these institutions which remind me about the psychology of the narcissists that you describe. And that's like something that really became evident to me yesterday. It's like, if we're mostly good in the world, why is there so much bad? Well, then it could be that there is a certain pattern of these institutions that maximize certain, they benefit certain aspects of personalities. And these certain aspects are the specific aspects that we could potentially see in narcissists and these three other personality disorders that you mentioned.
Yeah.
What are you, when I kind of make that that connection, yeah, that, because just reasonably looking at it, the pattern kind of suggests that then we should actually have a larger set of narcs in leadership positions, like you were on at the beginning, Alex, that there's a lot of leaders that are narcs.
Yeah, because we know they're drawn to power positions.
Exactly. So there should be like a natural relationship.
And I also like, and it's also kind of a natural thing. So like, if you have the good people, the empaths, if you call them that, and then you have the narcs. Like, if you look in a school setting as well, in a classroom with a teacher that is maybe afraid of conflict a little bit, or you have maybe a kid that's super smart, so that you don't want to entertain a conflict with the kid because they'll manipulate the situation and make your power as a teacher diminish that power so that you can't help the class at all, which happens with narcissistic, smart, manipulative little kids sometimes. But just the fact that in class, I remember growing up as a kid all through almost even high school, but not as much as in high school, because kids get smarter, so they're no longer attracted to the bad boys, if you will. Or bad girls, they're more attracted to knowledge, and they understand that, like, academic knowledge, there's more value in academic knowledge. But growing up to, like, ninth grade, so from 6 years old up until ninth grade, I always saw, I switched schools a fair bit, and visited schools and visited friends at other schools. And every school I went to, I saw the power dynamic be such that the mean people, the people who were willing to be mean, they were in the power structures. So like, if they beat you down, make you feel bad about yourself, or they kind of bully you, make you feel stupid, small, they were the ones in power in the class. Like, and you didn't want to go against them, and you avoided them at all costs. But behind doors, like, you knew that they were being stupid. They were the one in the wrong. You knew that. Like, they weren't just, you know, they were the bad guys.
Yeah, they were,
like,
guiding the culture. So yeah, actually, like, that bad behavior was actually spreading to the people that are normal, decent people.
Yeah.
And they started acting like shit.
Yeah, and they
that,
and
I love that example.
People.
I want to continue on to what you just said. I thought it was perfect. Mm. You described that the social dynamic that was created by these more narcissistic people, regardless of what school or country or people you were around, you always noticed the same pattern. Mm. You noticed that someone grabbed the power, became dominant, and then there was 90% of the rest were in submission, fearful of what to do, but coping in fear of being kicked out, right? Mm. So we could say that a government or a country per se is a reflection of the social dynamics of
that classroom.
Exactly. Because if you think about it, those characters in that classroom at that given time, they're used to that dynamic. Well, do you think they want to ever in their life lose that power? No. These people will continue trying to get to that power position at any place they go. Doesn't matter what school, doesn't matter what girlfriend they have, doesn't matter if they have kids, they are attracted to that power position. And here I'm talking about people with lack of empathy. I'm not talking about the average human. So the classroom, the mix of different personalities, such as we have in the city, is just a prediction of what will happen. And we see this. We see the devil, we see the Satan within some people so early on, and we see it happening over and over again in governments all over the world. Think of any dictator and tell me that they're not a narcissist. Think of any grandiose dictator that is so supreme and royal in his own way that he's just better and more clever than anyone, and tell me he's not a narcissist.
But that's interesting, because in a way, too, like, I just when you said that, I was thinking of Plato, and when he describes the perfect state, when he describes what he thought was utopia, then he kind of describes this benevolent leader who, like, it's not because he wants to be this charismatic, amazing person, but it's just because he knows the social order, if he just creates an order where, okay, like 80% of people, they get an assigned task in life that they're specifically assigned to, get really good at it, and this will actually bring you fulfillment, it will bring you meaning, and it will also allow us to get all the important things done in society. And then we have 20% that we kind of divide up across over more expert kind of things. Maybe that would be like a politician in ancient Greek, or a famous writer, or a famous poet, or something.
Or an artist.
Or an artist. In a way, that is a dictatorship. That was just a mind that flew in.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to respond to that, but I just thought it was interesting right now.
Go
in
on.
My head. But it, really what I wanted to get into beyond that sidetrack was, let's just start with a little caveat where I just want to say, like, why are we talking about this? Are we trying to, in this conversation, to prove that most leaders in the world are evil? No.
No.
That's not the point. What we're trying to do, again, is I want to educate myself through you guys, through me to you, because sometimes I learn shit when I just listen to myself. I want to raise the awareness, right? We want to raise that bar of ignorance so that we can identify these patterns in our leaders, so we know what leaders we probably shouldn't support because they're not empathetic. They're not people we want running the world. So that's just an awareness I want to create in this conversation. And so I like thinking about it.
Keep going if you're safe, but just throw the ball over here.
Okay, but I was going to throw it there. Okay. That's what I was.
Okay.
But what I'm curious in, like, one thing you mentioned to me is, like, you think, for example, Stefan Löfven might be a narcissist. What gives you this impression? Because, like, honestly, like, if I'm trying to raise my own awareness, I'm looking at Stefan Löfven. I can't say that my awareness right now in any way tells me he's a narcissist.
Yeah. So he seems like a sociopath to me. So he's a scared narcissist. Yeah. He's not a psychopath. He's a sociopath. It's the pathological lying, the lack of genuine expressions, the lack of emotional context in the discussion. He interrupts at very emotionally sensitive topics and says something completely ridiculous into it. He becomes reactive, emotionally reactive when he shouldn't, almost like a child. He has a very small backbone. He seems like he's enjoying what he's doing as well, and he's very manipulative. So I don't live in Sweden, but every time I've heard him speak or heard what he's done, it just reeks narcissist to me. This is not a normal person, that's for sure. And he's not the only one. There's many other ones. Remember, narcissists, they don't operate alone. They're all scared of each other. All narcs are scared of each other, and they manipulate and blackmail each other in order to cooperate with each other. So before you continue, Alex, with the Plato example, that's great, right? Plato, when was he alive? Do you remember?
Thousands of years ago.
Right? This guy, thousands of years ago, or 500 years ago, he was sitting and he was thinking about the same people, the same personality disorders.
How many years ago was Plato?
I think, Socrates was like 500 years before Christ.
So yeah, right. So
400 years or 450.
Yeah. Right.
So 2,500.
So like 2,500 years ago, we already had these kinds of parasitic personalities around us. And he's sitting there and thinking about it.
Like, how can I sort of trick the system into functioning even if we have the parasites?
Yeah. He's trying to detect them, identify them, talk about them, right? But obviously, whatever attempt he had was unsuccessful. Because if you look at just the most recent human history, it's still wars, it's still scams, it's fake news, it's the same narcissistic individuals.
Censorship of truth.
Censorship of truth.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. Out of the window, right? It's the same characters. So why are we here this April 2021 talking about something that is thousands of years ago, because no one has done anything about it.
And we haven't had the insight. We haven't had the emotional intelligence. We haven't had the, I mean, it's been such a, because back, way back then, for example, survival was a part of it, like being in the savannah. You know, like you didn't really, we didn't have the entitlement of feeling like the right system is the system where everyone's safe and everyone has a nice home and everyone, nobody can be attacked. Like we didn't have that concept even existing, I think. Like I don't, we had gladiators, you know. So like I don't, but I see your point though.
Yeah. Could I also want to say, like, it's not like we haven't come anywhere. Like the reason that there's three young dudes sitting around having this kind of conversation is in some form or way, society giving us the tools that we needed to get this mentality. And of course it's our parents. Of course it's the country we live in. But I don't want to be so pessimistic to say that the world isn't moving forward.
Absolutely.
I absolutely think it is.
I agree with you there. We shouldn't be too overly strong in those judgments. But also to remind ourselves, if I wouldn't have talked about these topics before, you know, maybe you guys wouldn't have identified them as well. And what if I didn't know about this? Do you guys think right. I went to uni?
The pathology is still there, which still, like, no matter how much better some things and some parts of the system might get, if the pathology is still coursing through the veins, the problem is still there. The parasite is not identified yet.
Yes.
Like, you haven't found any antidote.
Absolutely. And if you guys think that you can go to university, study psychology, and learn about these things that we're talking about now, which are very basic things for human survival, you're absolutely wrong. They're hiding information like this. Mm. I don't know about the Swedish system, probably the same, but it seems that the very rotten personalities that lead all of this orchestra, they do not want to be identified.
Is that because the funding a lot of times come from those type of sources, narcissistic sources?
Funding for the
funding
unis?
For research, funding for unis,
could be.
Funding
but
for
whatever they're doing, they're making sure that they're putting students focusing on topics that are not about identifying those narcissistic traits. They push them on any other direction. I even talked to a behavioral scientist in one of the unis that I went to, and she had very little knowledge about narcissism, manipulation, blackmailing. Very little knowledge. And this is a behavioral scientist professor. Yeah. Behavioral science.
And that's
professor.
Something very interesting, because when you say behavioral science and silence, you could say behavioral silence. Like when you were talking before, and I asked you to throw the ball over here, I was just thinking about the fact, like, people, when you have a conversation in a general room, even in a room where people are afraid of speaking of hard, complex, darker contexts and conversations, like when you're in a room and you're having a conversation with people that around a dinner table, for example, and you know that these people, you can go only this far to speak on sort of injustices in the world, because we don't want that to be the main topic of the dinner, because some people, when talking about the stuff, you know, they just don't want to be in that energy. They avoid this hard information to take in. And they also deny it. So they themselves deny the information that is clearly true in a lot of cases. And sometimes, even in rare occasions, they even deny facts that are right before their face. Like, it can be black and white facts, very clear, that a certain situation looks and is a certain way, and they'll just deny it as if it doesn't exist. But they will admit, and they will still admit to saying that, yeah, well, we live in a dog-eat-dog world. So they'll say that we live in a dog-eat-dog world, but they're too afraid to really look at the complex dynamics of hierarchical systems that we've built up through corporations and politics to really identify. So what does that mean? What does it mean to live in a dog-eat-dog world? Like, if that parasite of behavior permeates academia, permeates politics and corporations, and in a lot of corporations, not all of them, not all leaders, but a lot of them. And we know we live in a dog-eat-dog world. Why are we still wanting and trying and defending and trying to deny the let's call it true definitions of what a dog-eat-dog world turns into. It turns into cutting down forests, completely destroying ecosystems, destroying entire oceans and their entire ecosystem as well.
Killing countless animals all over the world for self-serving purposes.
Killing people to have self-service purposes gained once again even there. So, like, the empathy that people want to cling onto in sort of modeling, behaviorally modeling this, the world that they have, the control that they want to keep of a good world or a better world of good intention, whilst also, like, calling out any type of sort of denial of their fake fairy tale type of good intentioned world. They'll call them a conspiracy theorist or call them crazy or completely disregard them. But that person is actually trying to help save and, like, really make you aware of a really hard reality to understand of what a dog-eat-dog world in a complex human system, what that really looks like. Yeah. And it's the most evil, despiteful thing you could ever imagine. That's what a dog-eat-dog world creates. Yeah. It creates kids in cages where people from the white Western world goes and uses those white kids in cages or black kids in cages or Indian kids in cages. Mm. And they rape those kids. Like, that's how dark that dog eat dog world is. Mm. But it's denied. And the crazy part is that pedophilia is, like, one of the worst things I can imagine, for example. And the crazy thing is that these narcissists in these positions of power actually use, like, when you start going into really researching how dark this world can be, actually use the blame and attack of you, say, supposedly being a pedophile against empaths that are trying to shed light on the darkness of a system or of a situation.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a very, like, complex dynamic. Behaviorally, we admit that it's a dog eat dog world, but we are not ready to admit how dark a dog eat dog world in detail really becomes, and how it could even be possible.
Nice. There's a couple things I want to say here. First of all, I love that reflection. Great stuff. One is, like, I really like this idea of, like, the doggy eats dog world. For me, you know, what...
doggy.
Doggy eats doggy world. Another term for that, you know, survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And, like, when you were describing this world, you know, survival of the fittest, I think that's a lot of times how we've explained inequality in capitalism. It's how we've explained inequality in so many places, is this idea of survival of the fittest.
And there is emotionally intelligent survival of the fittest. Like, that exists. It's just that we pretend like it doesn't and like it's impossible. And that's actually because the people that are trying to make good are completely naive of the fact that you need kind of violence and fighting and actually comparing and competing.
Well, that too, but that's actually besides my point, because what I wanted to say was survival of the fittest is such a bad way of describing how human beings survive. It's not by, like, survival of the fittest, where the fittest person in one tribe survived. No, tribes survived by collaborating, by being empathetic. Mm-hmm. If you look at chimps, we were talking about yesterday, the alpha chimp in a herd is going to be the empathetic leader who is able to solve conflict, who is able to guide and help the younglings to become proper empathetic alpha males.
And lose in a fight when he needs to.
And right? So it's chimps, exactly. When they play with each other, they have to at least let the other chimp win, like, 35 to 20% of the time in order for them to even continue playing, because they'll stop playing otherwise. Yeah. So they learn empathy to play healthily, and leaders survive longer, chimp tribes, if you call them that, survive longer and have the longest survival rate when they have a leader that is empathetic to a certain extent.
Yeah, but what it brings out in my thoughts is just, like, this idea that capitalism and the self-interested doctrine that we're constantly preached, that's, like you're saying, that's the kind of behavior it breeds, but it's also built on a lie. Like, we're built to collaborate. We're built for team building and teamwork.
Yeah.
It's crazy that the, like, main doctrine of the world is, like, this lie that, oh, survival of the fittest, the life is tough. You know? No. Yeah. People that work together, stay together, and live better together.
Yeah. Live, love, laugh.
Now, what kind of a personality would even construct a sentence that says, dog eat dog world? What do you guys think? Is it a nice little empath? No, it's a narc.
And but I'd also say that that's just a result of history, too. Result of evolution. Because there was a long time, I'd say like probably the largest time of our existence has been a dog-eat-dog world. Like,
well, that's just because like sort of narcissists fear. Have been around.
It's fear-based.
They have been around here since forever. And they have been creating fear. Empaths don't scare each other. Right? Narcissistic people do. They scare each other.
But I think that's also like a bit too easy way to look at it because like, we all have narcissistic tendencies. I have narcissistic tendencies. I've scared people.
Yeah.
I'm not proud of it. Right. I've immediately regretted doing
that. That's the thing, right? You have self-reflection. You did something wrong. You learned from it. You never repeated it. And that is exactly what the narcissist lacks, is the self-awareness. And they will never change. They're resistant to change.
Yeah.
You can never become a narcissist, Edward. You can't. No matter what you want. Maybe if you take some really messed up drug, right? And you're hungry and you're 3 days awake and you're, you know, you're not yourself anymore. Maybe you would act in narcissistic
you
ways.
You live for a
you
while.
You know, I can be like, whatever I want to be and I want to be a narcissist.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Right? That's not the message today. But not guys, all of this, as you said, like, isn't it scary to realize that capitalism and all of these self-serving ideologies of how people should function are based off, you know, self-serving principles while we are mutual benefit people. So what is this all about? At the end of the day, it's all about either money or power, right? And now I want to ask you guys, I want to ask you, Edward, what would an empathic person do with money? And I want to ask you, Alex, what would a narcissistic person do with money? And how can these things influence the way we live life around us and the society as a whole throughout history? Who wants to start?
I can start. Well, I think that like my dream is always like if I get rich, I'm going to use that money to help the world.
Very empathetic. Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's healthy and logical. What else would you do with money?
Well, I would probably invest it in things I find interesting, but like in the way my values are aligned towards, you know, changing the world, helping the world, I'd want to invest it in like green energy. I'd want to invest it in vertical farming. I'd want to invest it in blockchain technology. I'd want to invest it in solutions that essentially can create a better tomorrow.
Exactly. So it seems that for an empathetic individual, money is a tool to create a more empathetic reality.
And I'd probably want a nice car, a nice house.
Yeah, sure.
I'd probably want to eat my face off at nice restaurants. You know, that's the truth, too.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, that was the truth for me, too. But then Corona came, and now I don't have any taste buds. Thank you for reminding me of that. So as a narcissist, if I really wanted to make money, I would look to maybe someone like you who wants to make the world better, maybe try to manipulate you and get more control in the company where that you're, you know, placing your money in order to maybe fix with the books a little bit, like maybe pretend like telling you like, the help is going here, but then maybe take and skim some money off of that and not think twice about it.
What would you do with that money as a narcissist?
Well, I'd invested in anything, wouldn't matter, anything that just multiplied my money. And I'd look for people who would, like, I'd look for quick money, too. And I, you know, it wouldn't matter if it's drugs, it wouldn't matter if it's prostitution, it wouldn't matter if it's, like, anything that just gives me more money.
So
like,
could you ever create a codependence in someone just because you have more money than them?
Oh, yeah, I'd manipulate everyone around me to sort of be my puppets for me to never feel alone and just always be there and just sort of accept my behavior. I wouldn't like let them try to better me or make me anything. They'd be under a tight leash under me.
So what kind of power dynamic would you create as a narcissist when you're abusing the powers of money self-servingly?
I'd find some information on the person under me that's closest to me, let's say, and I'd make sure that I know something really personal about them that they don't know, or that they know that I know, and I'd make sure that they're an empath, and I would make sure that they listen to anything I have to say, because the information I hold on them would make them look bad, and it would destroy their career, maybe, or something like that.
So eventually, just because you have money compared to the empath here, Edward's situation, you're actually fluctuating the power dynamic in a way where you're getting power. So we can see that capitalism, money, actually boosts narcissists' ability to have power over others. And in romantic relationships or friendships, what narcissists do is they create codependence, right? Toxic relationships. Girlfriend, you're not allowed to go anywhere. I'm the one that pays the rent. I'm the one that orders the food. What do you do? You are not smart. You're not pretty, right?
Nobody else would want to be with you. You should thank me for being with you.
Exactly. So they're gaslighting these girls just because they have the money to pay the rent. The narcissist has the money to pay the rent, right? So money isn't the purpose of life. It was created by really faulty individuals. And trading, fair enough, it makes sense. But money as a whole has completely ruined humanity. And I think...
But money as a whole, yeah, because I would like to say that the humans are the ones that make money a horrific
science. What humans?
Narcissistic people.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to be specific. Yeah. We can't say humans or women or men. What kind of men?
You can't say that money sucks either. Because it's also this development that allows us to have microphones in front of our face, have a fridge in my kitchen.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's not money. It's the people that abuse money and that have no ethics or morality to get as much money as possible.
So, because then also, like, so then let's, can we just, like, jump over a little bit quickly to then, like, looking at this issue that we have with the conversation surrounding equality, this concept of toxic masculinity. Could it be tied, this toxic masculinity and, like, violence in the home, for example, that we've seen spiked a lot during Corona, for example? Like, can we see a correlation between narcissism and violence and toxic masculinity?
100% connected with each other.
So it doesn't really have to do with masculine men. It has more to do with maybe narcissistic traits and the influence of narcissistic traits in our...
Both, but sorry, I shouldn't interrupt.
It's fine, man. Narcissistic men are abusive, and narcissistic women are abusive in any sort of way, and they will display antisocial traits. So antisocial traits are traits that are against society's norms. That's what antisocial means.
So, like, lying
is lying, antisocial? Beating, blackmailing, hitting, sexual harassment, whatever it is, right? And very masculine doesn't mean that you are some kind of condescending macho asshole.
Jock.
Right? A jock, some kind of asshole, better than everyone else. That's not what very masculine means.
That's
right?
Not what an alpha is.
Yeah. That's not what an alpha is, exactly. An alpha, as we discussed yesterday and we unanimously agreed, is alpha is a type of perception of life and the things you do and don't do. It's the way you empathize with those around you, but not with everyone, right? Because you cannot sympathize with a narcissist. They will just abuse that against you, turn it against you and abuse you in return. So an alpha is someone that is either masculine or feminine or both or whatever it is that helps the community in their context thrive with love and not live in fear. That's what alpha is. It's not about macho or misogynism. So,
and not like they're not afraid of comparing themselves to others because they don't. They have clear intentions.
Exactly.
They know how to play chess, like long-term effects positively compound.
Exactly. Long-term, that is what it's about. Narcissists think in the short term. Empaths think in the long term. We, as normal humans, we seem to have this patience and understanding that life is a long-term process. With narcissistic people, they have this impulsivity, this need to be at a power position, and they will try to manipulate anyone or anything to make them feel more like that. And that's what drives them. So when you were talking about toxic relationships,
toxic domestic abuse,
toxic masculinity, that is bred by narcissists. And that is glorified by like Netflix, Hollywood, those kinds of stuff, you know, those kinds of macho, misogynistic, very masculine, quote unquote,
less and
behaviors.
Less and less, like in those, but which is
absolutely
beautiful.
We need to give kudos to people, especially the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Internet jokes have changed so much. Mm. People are much more respectful now. Mm. They're calling out people that are being sexist or ageist or whatever it is. If you look at the comment sections now and 5 years ago, you're going to find that people are actually... There are actually people that are aware.
Change is happening.
Change is happening. They're leaving comments with the. They're taking the initiative. Just instead of sitting back like a conflict afraid person, they're taking the initiative to reply to a negative comment. Say, "Hey, you shouldn't say this. This is emotionally insensitive." La 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 la. You know, and they get a lot of likes.
I actually do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's
it's
really
like
good.
I just like go into a comment field and just diffuse the sort of emotion in the chat room or in the comment section by just like answering somebody who's angry completely neutrally, but also poking hole in the argument at the same time. It completely diffuses stuff.
Yeah. But it's so interesting too, because like we're back into this dynamic of the schoolyard. There's typically one troll in a, you know, comment section. It's typically one bully in the classroom. But it's interesting, like in our human nature also as empaths, that's where I have so much respect for you, Alex, because I feel like you have such a strong warrior within you. Where like, I mean, I've definitely done my part to interrupt and stop bullying. I've done my part to support people that have been bullied. But there's still to this day situations, you know, where you end up in like a very, just if it's a toxic masculine environment or just like overly masculine with even a bunch of empaths, but it's just being very masculine. Where, you know, things start to be said, things start to be malevolent, and it's so hard to call out. Where are you, like, I know that, you, Alex, you're very strong in that sense of, like, standing up to injustice. And I know that you are too, Rasmus, but I guess I know less about your life. How would you say that you react to narcissistic injustice in the daily?
You're asking me?
Mm-hmm.
Narcissistic injustice should be responded to in the same way as Alex just said, in a neutral fashion. You state very objectively the truth, the common truth or the proven truth, and you want to have as many people as possible who are involved listen to that, acknowledge it, provide them with the opportunity to for a counter argument. Say that, you know what, Rasmus, what you're saying is wrong. You always gotta allow that. And the narcissist will feel defeated. They will feel that, wow, my lies, my manipulation, la la la, it was in vain. And these people caught on to me. And
so what do I do?
Flee. Yeah, so they will, depending on the rage within the narcissist and the mood they're in, they might play victim. They might become angry. If they're drunk, maybe they're going to be physically trying to assault someone or
they
whatever.
They might come up with a complete lie about you, making a story up.
Absolutely.
That is completely from nowhere.
Exactly.
To make you look bad. Because
that's a really good point. Like, if you discredit a narcissist with, rightfully, right?
Objective facts, let's say.
Yeah. If you use objective facts to discredit a narcissist and you've done it correctly... That's fine. That's done. And everyone agrees. But he doesn't agree, right? So what is he thinking now? He's going to do the same thing to you, but he's going to do it in an inobjective fashion. So he's going to lie about you. He's going to tell people you did something that you didn't do. He's going to say...
Like, say that you're at a bar. This is like an example I see in front of me. So like in a bar, they would... Say you see him treating a woman inappropriately.
Yeah.
And you confront him about it, yeah. And it's clear that you've confronted him, yeah. And now he's in a corner. So he'll,
yeah.
And then he'll do something like say, "Well, I mean, I saw you slap that girl's ass just 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So like, why are you any better than me?"
Exactly.
And then everyone at the room will, or in the conversation, will look at you as if you're an exactly. asshole now. And if you're not calm, neutral, you'll simply go over to the woman that he pointed at, bring her into the circle, and look her in the eyes and say, "Did I slap you on the ass 5 minutes ago?" And she'd say no. And then you can just let her go along the way and then say, "Okay, so what's up?"
Exactly. Because if you become reactive and you say, "No, I didn't slap any girl on the ass. What are you talking about?"
It's going to look like
the narcissist is going to say, "Wait, why are you getting so reactive? Why are you getting so reactive? You're obviously hiding something."
And that's what they do in politics.
Yeah, 100%. And this is on loop,
yeah.
Every day, forever, and we need to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, but politics is such a tricky case because the whole institution is built on pointing out how the other is different from you,
and
that's
doing
that's
wrong,
the exact opposite of what an empath wants to do. At least I'm always, "Hey, I'm amazing, you're amazing, absolutely. We're all amazing.
Can we just calm down and try to solve this together?
Yeah. Yeah. Can we all just feel like we're amazing, please?"
Please.
Okay, but another thing that was like very, very exciting about yesterday is like we were talking about these narcissists. We were talking about that this urge of wanting to change the world in our different ways. And we're talking about how these institutions of nation states of our economics and capitalism, how it seems to be like there seems to be a pattern of self-interest and like self-aggrandizing, self-maximization in these institutions that are similar to a narcissist or these three personality disorders. And we got into the conversation of like how can we possibly change that then? Because the fact is, we are mostly good people on this planet. We're mostly good intentioned. And something I think is really interesting to tie into this conversation is this idea of blockchain, is this idea of cryptocurrencies. Because for quite a few reasons. Like, first of all, I love the fact that blockchain and cryptocurrencies kind of inspire a conversation which is very important in a society. Like, what is money? What is banking? It's forcing us to look at these crucial, crucial social institutions and understand them better when we want to do the investment. So that's one thing I love about it. But what is blockchain? It can often be very confusing. And in the same way that, like, an institution is almost like a third party, I'm thinking now of the politics, I'm thinking now of all these different profit or self-interest maximizing institutions we've been speaking about, is that they are then governed by humans, right? And these humans then, because they have these aspects in their personalities, there's a higher percentage that there's more narcs than there should be in these positions. There's a high probability that there's more narcs than there should be in these positions.
Yes.
And what can we then do about it? Because like society is complex. Narcissists will always infiltrate these positions, so to speak.
Society is compromised.
But we're starting to uncover a technology and we're starting to understand how we can use it to start changing this. Because blockchain is really replacing the third party, where we replace that third party, like a bank or a hospital or a school, with technology which verifies all the information and make sure that, like, if an empath is doing well, empath is rewarded. It can't be manipulated by this third party.
Yeah.
Your vote can't be manipulated.
Yeah.
Your money can't be taken from you
yes.
if you put it in the bank or in the blockchain. Alex, do you want to expand a little bit on this? Because it was kind of you who made the connection yesterday. Total credit there. But I think it's very, very inspiring, this idea that it might actually be technology. It might be this local to global connection, which is actually the solution to these problems that have festered for so long.
Yeah, because I think that people do fear technology in the sense where it's like they see this like maybe Black Mirror-esque reality of more control, more surveillance, more, and like that all is true. and reality. Like, blockchain could turn into the most dystopian nightmare we could even imagine if narcissists or traditional old systems try to sort of gain some kind of control over it to the point where it becomes a centralized institution in any case. So, like, the for example, the voting is very interesting. Like, traditionally, you trust the trusted third party to look over the entire election going through in whatever country, in whatever way.
Yeah, I think the most tangible example right now is the U.S. past U.S. election, where Trump was hard on that there was an election fraud. And then which makes it questionable because there's this human interference in the voting system, which creates questions.
Yeah.
And this technology that you're now talking about, it's removing that human interference.
Yeah, and the way that it does it, it basically just creates pre-programmed, pre-ordained rules to a system that only has one function, which would be then, for example, for you to vote. So, like, you wouldn't be able to manipulate it. It would be just made perfect, in a sense, in a very simple format. So maybe one address is connected to your ID, which is connected to the state, which would be fully verifiable then, so there wouldn't be a double spending type problem. Like, there wouldn't be extra votes from non-existent people. You would count how many IDs are in this country, and this is how many addresses we then create and connect to various personal identification numbers, for example. Then you create a fair vote. But then there's also another way of looking at where you can have education, for example, and you can completely, perfectly monitor the results of your students, the intellect, the level of speed that they can compute various problems and learning, and if they're better at reading or if they're better at thinking, or if they're, like, you can create really complex dynamic systems that actually surveil us, but with the intention then to gain, create, and extract more potential from human beings in general. And you can, so like, that's the potential of blockchain then, you know, and it's a decentralized system, which means that there isn't a central authority governing all of the transactions, like a bank, for example, which is a central institution with central servers. Rather, it's a pre-chosen structure of code that is non-corruptible, that is distributed all over the world. So, like, you could hold a server, I could hold a server, Rasmus could hold a server. Anyone could basically build up a node, like a connection in the network, to actually help compute and drive the blockchain forward. And there are also, like, centralized blockchains, like, that are more central, and some are more decentralized, because sometimes decentralization is also ineffective.
Yeah, so, I think the best way to describe it is, like, in the same way that we have states that are designed differently, we have republics, we have democracies, we have all these different ways to design institutions.
Yeah, so imagine,
you can design a blockchain.
Yeah, and exactly. And imagine, yeah. So imagine then, like, in, say, the States, we have a free market, but we don't know that all companies always abide by the rules that they need to, rules and regulations that they need to follow in order to drive their company forward. They keep finding loopholes and they keep doing negative things, and if regulation comes in, they just find a new way of doing the same thing, maybe somewhere else or in the same country in a different way with different tax evasion methods, basically, like, just as an example. In a pre-programmed blockchain, you would remove the ability to, for example, pay off a judge in order to keep up malevolent behavior. So, like, the judge wouldn't, like, a human party of a judge wouldn't be there. It would be programmed into a system, and you couldn't, your business that you're trying to create would have to follow the rules and regulations that are based on the blockchain, the platform that you build your company on. So you can't cheat the code, in a sense, and there'd be a heavy vetting process instead. So, like, maybe people who actually work with vetting new companies coming in, making sure that they're doing what they're saying that they're doing, but then the general regulation of the company that they need to follow, say ethics for sustainable outcomes, like maybe you're a textile corporation and you try to create textiles, well, you're not allowed to be on this blockchain that is highly efficient and has access to billions of customers. if, for example, the wastewater from your textile industry is bad for the ecosystem and the water where you're letting out the water or the rest water from creating textiles.
I have a question for you, Alex. Mm. So maybe to explain it a little bit simpler for everyone listening. So are you kind of suggesting that instead of having your own money circulating in this society as we know now, which seems to be kind of narcissistic and not and kind of ill-intentioned sometimes, would you say that instead of having your money circulate here, would it be better to invest into blockchain where you can actually pick a certain ideology that you support,
intention,
knowing that it will be unconditionally supporting that intention?
Yeah, and that's kind of how what I look at, like investing in Bitcoin for me. And I felt this, I've felt this for so long. Mm. But it's like for me, investing in Bitcoin, and because Bitcoin is just the reaction of blockchain tech, and then the evolution of Bitcoin is like, let's say, a layer one application and generation one application. And then the blockchains that are being created now that are actually scalable and you can actually apply them to the real world in various ways that is more advanced than just being a money transaction system is generation three. So generation two was being able to program and manipulate and build businesses based off of blockchain. But when I look at it, to answer your question, when I look at investing in Bitcoin, it's like voting and investing at the same time. So I'm investing in the future. I'm investing in safe intermediaries and platforms that basically work with hindsight bias. And we know what hindsight bias is. It's like when you say that you invest in the stock market and your stocks go up, but then, and you get the feeling like, should I sell now? You're like, maybe I should sell now. No, I'll just keep it. Like if I hold it for 10 years, it's still going to go further. And then it goes down like 40%. And you're like, man, I knew I should have sold.
Yeah.
Like I knew it. Like I could have done it. So next time I'm going to do it.
Mm.
But next time the circumstances have changed and the variables have changed. And you do the same shit and you lose a bunch of money instead.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's hindsight bias. Humans are highly affected by hindsight bias. Typical easy situations, like somebody tells you a joke and you don't have a good comeback, and then you lie in bed at night and you're like, oh man, I should have said that. That would have been fucking awesome. Like that's a typical, like we're just really guarded by that, or like created under it. Blockchain tech has the ability to basically utilize hindsight bias of the traditional system and previous blockchains to create something even better all the time, over and over and over, and it's constantly evolving. So look, Cardano, for example, which is my favorite partner. You can bleep out the name of the blockchain if you don't want to, like, because this is not financial advice. You should always do your own research when you're doing this kind of thing. So this entire conversation has nothing to do with you as a listener investing. It's just that this is what I feel in regards to this technology. But if you look at Cardano, for example, because there's a huge problem with Bitcoin, for example, right now with it being not very sustainable. It's drawing a lot of electricity in. And because of how the market is built, the cheapest electricity is the most dirty and disgusting electricity. So a lot of entities are being drawn to cheap, gross, environmentally disastrous electricity sources, basically. But then you look at Cardano, for example, and they have basically increased the scalability of the blockchain by 6,000-fold, and they made it 6,000, and they made it even further when it comes to the sustainability of the blockchain. The energy that it utilizes in order to produce a computation is super low. Like even the, let's just say 6,000 there again. So like the evolution is exponential. Unbelievably fast this stuff is growing.
Yeah, and let's think about that too, because like the way you're putting those numbers, that would be 6,000 times 6,000, because they're solving two different issues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So like there's these compounding effects.
Yeah, and I actually think it doesn't have to do with the transaction speed. I think that's even higher. I think so if we just take that back and say that Cardano has basically reduced the emissions and needs of use of electricity to produce a computation by 6,000-fold. So they've like drawn down they've made the most sustainable and scalable blockchain that there's out there right now, basically. Yeah.
When
scalability and sustainability counted in.
Yeah. I just want to repeat what you said, because I thought it was such a well put or condensation of what I was saying. It was essentially like when we put our money into a bank, when we put our money into a hedge fund, there's a certain degree to which, of course, we kind of know what they're doing, but not really.
And that's why insider trading,
exactly, like, they could be doing insider trading, and you know, yes, of course, they have this ethical board, and they have all these bunch of ethics, but it's humans involved. There's a lot of power and money involved, which
and we know who,
tends to
who likes money and power.
We know who surfaces there, and here, instead of putting it into those subjective parties, you're putting it into these third parties that are technological. They're based on code. They're engineers, and so like the risk for human interference and manipulation
and corruption
disappears in once we have all the ideal technology in place.
Yeah, and that makes it so that things like 5G and surveillance for the safety of others, surveillance maybe even in the forest to be able to prevent mass like fires in the Amazon forest or in Australia. Mm. Medicine, like your medical records, it wouldn't be something that your doctors can access. It would be something that you allow your doctor to access because it's connected to you.
Mm.
And you can then, like, when you die and you allow your organs to be donated to somebody that might need them, you could choose to donate your data and medical records and choose what parts of it, too, if you want.
Powerful.
For other people to sort of utilize it. And it could be anonymous. It could be non-anonymous. And you could make data, your social media data, for example, rather than corporations taking your data, hiding the fact from you that they are doing this, and then sell it to a third party for them to make money off of you, Facebook, and then the third party, the retailer, the one marketing things to you. Yeah. It could rather be a three-party exchange where you get money for your data, and the revenue and parts of the revenue that is generated from your data is handed over back to you because you're sharing your data, and you could choose not to share it at all. And that's how social media will change. And that's how blockchain, amazing blockchain is, because it just needs a little time and it will
mature.
It will mature and it will grow through and it will effectivize so exponentially.
Yeah.
That I think that it's one of the greatest hopes that we have in order to remove confirmation bias and remove our emotional nervous system that constantly takes in impressions and are affected, and our choices that we make are affected by those impressions that we take in, false impressions and real impressions. It just makes us less corruptible.
Yeah, and I think, again, just a very neat way to kind of use a heuristic, or the way to remember this, the way to understand this, again, just breaking it down into a simpler model where, again, all these third-party institutions, like a bank, like we've been mentioning, it's not that they're set out to be subjectively malevolent or that they're there to get you. The problem is just like with human interference, this arises, and having a third-party system which is objective at its core because it is technology and not human. That's why we can avoid all the kind of human manipulation that would have been allowed in a third party, which is run by humans. Even if in paper that they have an objective reason to be scientific, to be, you know, subject or to be objective, they end up being subjective.
Like, imagine if you're an artist and just like this is only artistry. Like, you release an NFT, a painting on the blockchain, because you can make a painting unique on a blockchain. Yeah. So that there you can't replicate it. It's like there's one original and you can find it at this place on the blockchain. So imagine if you took that painting and you wanted to set a certain type of rule onto this painting. So everyone can always speculate on the value of this painting after you've bought it. And say then that you could take this money, and when this painting is sold for the remainder of its existence, say that it changes hands 30 times, you could pre-program it so that 30% of the profits of every single time this painting is traded goes to a certain cause.
Yeah, and we could even see it where it's like certain artists that maybe have created amazing artwork, they sell it for a cheap amount of money because they don't really value themselves. But then in 20 years, that art piece is worth a shit ton of money because the art community picked it up and started hailing it.
Yeah.
Then they could actually get a cut of that money too.
Mm, yeah.
So like there's so many different applications. And again, like the only limit is now human creativity in designing the system.
Yeah.
But it's not human emotion in running the system.
And the cool thing then is when human creativity is the only limit, that's when empaths and creatives take over, because narcissistic intentions are really easy to decipher when you look at it in code, when you look at it in data like that, clearly on a piece of paper.
Nice one.
So then people naturally gravitate towards the less narcissistic energies of the creative force that comes with blockchain.
Yeah.
Nice. I wanted to say, first of all, really, really well, like, put together words, Edward. And Alex, thank you so much already yesterday for talking about blockchain in such a manner. I thought I knew about blockchain, you know, I've heard some episodes and stuff, but the way you made it seem so practical and so anti-narcissist, basically, I think it really shows the relevance of it. And I think we should be talking to all of our grandmas and grandpas about this thing right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I really feel, as you said, blockchain is a reaction to many things.
It's
but
a natural
for
balance.
Me, as a psychologically passionate person, blockchain seems to be the reaction to narcissism.
Yeah.
It creates independence, creates a structure, creates rationality, creates code.
And it sort of builds up a technological autoimmune system that negates narcissistic
tendencies.
Absolutely
amazing. So really, nowadays, in the 21st century, you're going to be happy if you're a 21st century freak, but also if you learn how to see life and protect yourself in two ways. You need to first understand we're dependent of other people. We're humans. Empathy doesn't work if it's just you in the room. We're dependent of others, and we have to accept that, and money. So we need others, and we need money, right? Now, for the money part, do as Alex said, or don't, right? But be aware of blockchain, okay? Because it seems to be a very rational solution for the money part of your life.
Web 3.0, so it's like, it's the evolution of the internet.
And for the social part, the necessity of us being around each other. Do what I do. Study psychology. Study personality psychology. Study personality disorders. Study mannerisms. Study cultures.
And recognize that the topic of, like, for example, narcissists and their existence and their effect on a system, how that fact is actually trying to be hidden a little bit, or kind of not maybe hidden, but the information is withheld.
Yes.
And not mentioned too
much. Talking about narcissistic people or behavior shouldn't be an uncomfortable topic.
Yeah.
It should be an encouraged topic so that everyone learns and teaches. It should not make anyone uncomfortable, because the idea is that you learn, right? And if you feel uncomfortable learning, you're probably going to have a harder time protecting yourself and others in your life, and it's completely up to you to do what you want to do, really. Yeah.
And you should do like Edo. I love people and believe in their amazing ability to actually be amazing.
Yeah.
And that they are.
Because warriors such as we are with Alex and then you as well, me and Alex, we do it in a more pressurized way. We need to see that there are people that are emotionally stable, loving, good-hearted people that are there.
And that I wanted to defend as well.
That give us energy to fight.
And that's where masculinity is super powerful and super important. And that's how like healthy masculinity can evolve as well, because we want to defend. We want to create a better castle for everyone, so to speak. And also, like, because I also look at this, like, a lot of people feel a lot of like sort of emotional chaotic feelings towards truth and towards like confrontation and things like that. And for me, I really don't feel that. Like, I have like an emotional desensitized reaction towards it. Like any darkness, it doesn't matter how dark it becomes, it doesn't take over my nervous system in a sense.
Yeah.
And that's the power of critical thinking and combining it with emotional intelligence.
Nice. Very true.
So like, like, I don't like this thing about, it's easy to talk about, like, you and I speak a lot of truth and we speak on hard subjects, for example. But really, in a like interesting intellectual conversation dynamic, our emotions aren't part of the conversation of reality. Like, we shouldn't be too attached to what we want things to be. And that takes out a lot of emotion out of the conversation, and it makes it easier for you to live in a world where you're curious about how the world is going to surprise you with a new variable that you weren't ready to had any awareness of being existent, and completely changing your perspective of something that you thought you already understood. Like, that should actually be approached with a playfulness. And that, for me, is the sort of spiritual playfulness of maintaining your childlike behavior and being curious in life and wanting to investigate things. That, like, your reality of how you choose to define a world where the world is good, for example, for you, and where it falls apart if negative realities and variables are implemented into your new, like, perspective, that your world falls apart there, well, that's really just an illusion. Like, that's not what reality is. Reality is who you are in the present moment, and what you feel like you want to do when confronted with and faced with the facts of hard truths to take in. That's who you are. That's the reality you should reside in. Mm. There is no tunnel dark enough to not eventually find a source of light, you know? So like, I just really feel like diffusing this fear of talking about things we don't yet understand that conflict with our image of the world is... like, and approach it with more playfulness and being okay with I don't know everything. Like, that's the best sort of intention to have. Like, I don't know everything, so it's fun when my bubble is popped and my perspective is forced to expand, you know? Yes. Even if it's hard, you know? Yeah, yeah. It's still fun, even if it's hard. Like, stop looking for the easy battle. There is no easy battle.
Well, amen to that. I think beautiful words from both of you. I really appreciate what you said, Rasmus. I really appreciate what you said there at the end here, Alex. And to be honest, it reminds me that I'm amazing. You're amazing. We're all amazing. Yeah. Thanks so much, boys. Great conversation. Thank
you, I love you guys so much, man.
Yeah, I love you guys too.
Thank you for the time and... Well,
thanks for pushing onward and still being loving in the way that you are.
Yeah.
It really is. It's amazing. And it's so encouraging and it's inspiring and it's hard.
Mm.
That's one of the things that actually conflicts in me when I see too much love. And it's like that makes me kind of like annoyed, for example. Mm. But I know about myself that is wrong and it's the wrong reaction.
Yeah. And on that note, like, I think the meditation at the beginning of each episode is in many ways, like in my thinking, is trying to embody what you just mentioned here. Like, just like breathe, accept reality for what it is. And when you accept reality for what it is, you realize again, shit, we're so similar. We're so alike. I'm not that different from everybody else. And I am, but I'm not. Da, 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 da. But breathing into that experience, being playful with it, seeing where it takes us, it's a much more exciting life than fearing change. And I think also, like, if all of us are running around feared or afraid, then all those fucking narcs are gonna come and take over too. So we got to stay positive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gotta
stay they're looking positive. At you like, why are you reacting so much?
You have so much power.
Should we leave some little contacts as well if someone wants to get in contact with us?
Yes, please do it.
Yeah, would you want to start?
My Instagram, Alex Veeam, with a punctuation in between the two E's in the last name.
So Alexve period E-M.
No, not period, punctuation. E-M.
Yeah, period.
Is that period?
Yeah, it's period.
Oh, sorry. Okay, yeah, sorry. I thought that was metal and slow.
Yeah, so it's period, not period, it's period.
Yeah, it's period.
Period.
Nice. My Instagram is smilebrighttherapies. And maybe I was a little bit passionate during this conversation because I really care about these topics. But I can assure you, I'm a very tranquil person, so don't feel afraid to reach out to me. If you identify any of these topics that we've talked about as potential sources of any kind of problems in your life, feel free to leave me a message, voice clip, be anonymous, be whatever. Reach out to me, whatever problems you have. I'm always down to help, always interested. Smile Breath Therapies, once again, and study psychology, people. It will really help you and your future generations out.
Beautiful.
Cool.
Thank you.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Peace out, guys.
Yo, 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 yo